Hello, and welcome to Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. It's July 10th, 2016. Here's what's ahead on today's program. In our weekly Higher Education Report, correspondent Pete Musto tells us about two students who have found a lot more than they expected at the University of Texas at Austin. Then, Ana Mateo will be with us with Words and Their Stories. This week, Ana will tell us about the word psychobabble. It has only existed since the 1970s. And as we always do on the Sunday edition of Learning English Weekend, we will present The Making of a Nation. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the voice of America. Now, as we do every Sunday, we tell you what is happening in American higher education. Today's report is part of our new series about international students who are studying at colleges and universities across the United States.
Diana Ayoub did not think she would study in the U.S. after finishing high school. Ayoub was born in Cairo, Egypt. She says the Egyptian education system is all about memorization. There are few chances for students to get experience using what they learn in the classroom. Making the choice to attend a university in a foreign country is never easy. But Ayoub felt the education system in her home country lacked the resources and methods she desired. By her first year in high school, Ayoub knew she needed to leave Egypt to get the kind of education she wanted. So she enrolled in the African Leadership Academy, or ALA, in 2012. The ALA is a special private high school in South Africa. With students from 45 different countries, the ALA trains leaders to help solve issues across the African continent. Ayoub did not know how to apply to schools in the U.S. The ALA college counselors helped her move through the complex application process. She also applied to the African Leadership Bridge Scholarship Program to help pay for her education.
I had no idea what was an SAT, I didn't know what was a GPA, I didn't know I had to write college essays and applications, but thank God I got good support from my college counselors.
Then, Ayoub chose to seek an undergraduate degree in economics at the University of Texas at Austin in 2014. The University of Texas at Austin, or UT Austin, was founded in 1883. The public research university is one of 14 schools in the University of Texas system. UT Austin is located in Austin, the capital city of the state of Texas. With a world-class music scene, Austin is called the live music capital of the world. The city is also famous for its wild outdoor art and ethnic food trucks. In recent years, many technology companies have moved into the city. the cost of living has risen. Some people are worried that Austin is losing its artistic spirit. There is an effort to support local business called Keep Austin Weird. This motto appears on t-shirts and bumper stickers around the city. Every year, the city holds a large festival celebrating new music, art, and technology called South by Southwest. President Barack Obama spoke at the event in 2016. Ayub is a Coptic Christian, a religious minority in Egypt. She knew what it felt like to be different from most people before coming to the U.S. But Ayub says that in Austin, everyone is different, so everyone is accepted for who they are.
There's no one weird in Austin. It's normal to be weird. I knew that I'm never going to be judged for my culture or my background.
The decision to study at UT Austin was not as difficult for Carlos Galdiano. Galdiano is from Mexico City, Mexico, a four-hour flight from Austin. He says moving to Austin did not require much money. Galdiano also received a scholarship after enrolling at UT Austin in 2012. The scholarship came from the Mexican government agency called the National Council for Science and Technology. Galdiano is earning his doctorate degree, or PhD, in civil engineering, studying how water and energy are used. He wanted to study under some of UT Austin's more well-known professors: Dane McKinney, David Maidment, and Michael Weber are all experts in Galdiano's field of study. Galdiano says the main problem for him was what he thought about the U.S. before arriving. The U.S. and Mexico have long had a difficult relationship. The media in both countries often comment on the negative beliefs that people in the U.S. have about people from Latin America. Some people in the U.S. believe the border between the countries should be closed. Galdiano was concerned he would be treated poorly because of his nationality or race. But soon he learned many people in the U.S. are welcoming to foreigners.
Every time someone asks me if I feel threatened or not wanted in this country, I would say no. Not all Americans think that way. I was expecting people only thinking about themselves, but I really found that they also care a lot about other causes outside the U.S.
Galdiano had other problems when he arrived. His wife had an F2 visa at first, which meant she could not work or study. This made life in the U.S. difficult for her. Also, Galdiano had to learn that some common Mexican customs were unacceptable in the U.S. For example, people in Mexico often kiss each other on the cheek when they meet. Most people in the U.S. avoid physical contact unless they know the other person very well. But Galdiano says willingness to be open to new ideas makes life as an international student in the U.S. easier.
You definitely have to be more tolerant. So I think I've been growing more as a person that way.
Galdiano is now a teaching assistant, or TA, for a class called Projects with Underserved Communities. Graduate students often work as TAs for professors in the same academic department. Galdiano and the professor help the students in the class design projects serving rural communities in developing countries. The students work with non-governmental organizations in these countries. If the students can raise the money needed, they can travel to those countries and make their projects happen. In 2016, Galdiano's students were able to travel to India, Tanzania, and Guatemala. He says everything he learned about fitting in at UT Austin has helped him teach his students. Understanding differences and accepting different opinions is very important, he adds. The more people try to understand each other, the easier it is for them to solve the world's problems. I'm Pete Musto.
Thanks, Pete. And Pete and I hope you'll join us every Sunday over the next several weeks as we bring you more stories about international students and their experiences at American colleges and universities. Now, if it's Sunday, it's time for Ana Mateo and Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs.
Each week, we tell about and explain sayings in American English. Today, it is different types of psychobabble. Psychobabble is a fairly new word in the English language. For about 40 years, people have been using psychobabble to describe the language of popular psychotherapy. Psychotherapists are specialists in treating mental or emotional disorders. They talk with patients about their problems instead of using medicine or drugs. Psychobabble can be used in areas other than the world of psychotherapy. Often these words find their way into everyday language. Sigmund Freud is said to be the father of psychoanalysis. He opened up new ways of thinking about the mind. Freud, in his work on unconscious, suppressed desires, also led to several new expressions. Among these is the saying, a Freudian slip. A Freudian slip is something people say accidentally that shows their true feelings. We also call this a slip of the tongue. Freud explored the feelings that people keep buried deep inside themselves. They fail to recognize they are keeping their feelings hidden. Those feelings are bottled up inside the individual, Freud said. And sometimes these bottled up feelings come out in uncontrolled ways. Here is an example. In 2004, Condoleezza Rice served as National Security Advisor to the President of the United States, George W. Bush. She was unmarried at the time, and there were reports that she spent much of her time with the President and his wife, Laura. At a dinner party one night, Rice was talking with a group of people. She reportedly said, As I was telling President Bush, some reporters wrote that Rice's Freudian slip might have shown how she really felt about Bush. Sigmund Freud also defined parts of the human mind. In Freud's thinking, a mind is divided into three parts. The ego is the part of the mind that senses and reacts to changes in the real world. The superego is the part that relates to ideas about what is right and wrong, and to feelings of guilt. The id is the part of our unconscious minds that relate to one's basic needs and desires. Of these three parts, it is the ego that is used in common expressions. If someone is said to be on an ego trip, they are only thinking of themselves. We also use this expression as a verb, saying that someone is ego-tripping. To stroke someone's ego is to praise them in order to get what you want. For example, if your supervisor is difficult to work with, just stroke his ego. Tell him he has the best ideas and that you are learning a lot from him. If this boss is egocentric, all those nice comments just might work. Egocentrics are people who care too much for themselves and not enough about others. Egomania is the state of being egocentric. You could say an egomaniac lives in the state of egomania. However, an alter ego is the exact opposite of an ordinary personality. In literature, one of the most famous examples of an alter ego appears in the book The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson. This story became so famous that the saying Jekyll and Hyde now means a person who is different in moral character from one situation to the next. For example, you could say, she has a real Jekyll and Hyde personality. One minute, she's nice and quiet. The next, she is shouting at people and insulting them. Other personality types have made it out of the doctor's office and into American English. Take a type A personality, for example. A type A is said to be aggressive and very competitive. Researchers started using this expression in the 1950s when they explored the connection between type A personalities, stress, and heart disease. In the 1970s, the term type A found its way into everyday language. Type A's are often described as overachievers, goal-oriented, and driven. Such individuals have a hard time waiting in lines, taking it easy, and getting away from work. Their main concern is their career. This may sound bad, but type A people are actually highly effective in the workplace. And perhaps people who are a little type A are also good at learning English. I'm Ana Mateo.
Thanks, Anna. Now, as we do every Sunday, we present The Making of a Nation.
The 1920s are remembered as a quiet period in American foreign policy. The nation was at peace. Americans elected three Republican presidents in a row: Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. These conservatives in the White House were generally more interested in economic growth at home than in relations with other countries. But the United States had become a world power. It was tied to other countries by trade, politics, and shared interests. And America had gained new economic strength. This week in our series, Bob Doty and Shirley Griffith discuss American foreign policy during the 1920s.
Before World War I, foreigners invested more money in the United States than Americans invested in other countries, about $3 billion more. The war changed this. By 1919, Americans had almost $3 billion more invested in other countries than foreign citizens had invested in the United States. American foreign investments continued to increase greatly during the 1920s. Increased foreign investment was not the only sign of growing American economic power. By the end of World War I, the United States produced more goods and services than any other nation, both in total and per person. Americans had more steel, food, cloth, and coal than even the richest foreign nations. By 1920, the United States' national income was greater than the combined incomes of Britain, France, Germany, Japan, Canada, and 17 smaller countries. Quite simply, The United States had become the world's greatest economic power.
America's economic strength influenced its policies toward Europe during the 1920s. In fact, one of the most important issues of this period was the economic aid the United States had provided European nations during World War I. Americans lent the Allied countries $7 billion during the war. Shortly after the war, they lent another $3 billion. The Allies borrowed most of the money for military equipment and food and other needs of their people. The Allied nations suffered far greater losses of property and population than the United States during the war. And when peace came, they called on the United States to cancel the loans America had made. France, Britain, and the other Allied nations said the United States should not expect them to repay the loans.
The United States refused to cancel the debts. President Coolidge spoke for most Americans when he said simply, "They borrowed the money." He believed the European powers should pay back the war loans, even though their economies had suffered terribly during the fighting. However, the European nations had little money to pay their loans. France tried to get the money by demanding payments from Germany for having started the war. When Germany was unable to pay, France and Belgium occupied Germany's Ruhr Valley. As a result, German miners in the area reduced coal production. And France and Germany moved toward an economic crisis and possible new armed conflict.
An international group intervened and negotiated a settlement to the crisis. The group provided a system to save Germany's currency and protect international debts. American bankers agreed to lend money to Germany to pay its war debts to the Allies. And the Allies used the money to pay their debts to the United States.
Some Americans with international interests criticized President Coolidge and other conservative leaders for not reducing or canceling Europe's debts. They said the debts and the new payment plan put foolish pressure on the weak European economies. They said this made the German currency especially weak, and they warned that a weak economy would lead to serious social problems in Germany and other countries. However, most Americans did not understand the serious effect that international economic policies could have on the future of world peace. They believed that it was wrong for the Europeans, or anyone, to borrow money and then refuse to pay it back.
Many Americans of the 1920s also failed to recognize that a strong national military force would become increasingly important in the coming years. President Coolidge requested very limited military spending from the Congress, and many conservative military leaders refused to spend much money on such new kinds of equipment as submarines and airplanes. Some Americans did understand that the United States was now a world power and needed a strong and modern fighting force. One general, Billy Mitchell, publicly criticized the military leadership for not building new weapons. But most Americans were not interested. Many Americans continued to oppose arms spending until the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in Hawaii in 1941.
American policy toward the League of Nations did not change much in the 1920s. In 1919, the Senate denied President Wilson's plea for the United States to join the new League of Nations. The United States, however, became involved unofficially in a number of League activities, but it continued to refuse to become a full member. And in 1930, the Senate rejected a proposal for the United States to join the World Court. The United States also continued in the 1920s to refuse to recognize the communist government in Moscow. However, trade between the Soviet Union and the United States increased greatly during this period. And such large American companies as General Electric, DuPont, and RCA provided technical assistance to the new Soviet government.
The Coolidge administration was involved actively in events in Latin America. Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes helped several Latin American countries to settle border disputes peacefully. In Central America, President Coolidge ordered American Marines into Nicaragua when President Adolfo Diaz faced a revolt from opposition groups. The United States gave its support to more conservative groups in Nicaragua, and it helped arrange a national election in 1928. American troops stayed in Nicaragua until 1933. However, American troops withdrew from the Dominican Republic during this period. And Secretary of State Hughes worked to give new life to the Pan-American Union.
Relations with Mexico became worse during the 1920s. In 1925, Mexican President Plutarco Elias Calles called for laws to give Mexico more control over its minerals and natural wealth. American oil companies resisted the proposed changes. They accused Calles of communism, and some American business and church leaders called for armed American intervention. However, the American Senate voted to try to settle the conflict peacefully, and American diplomat Dwight Morrow helped negotiate a successful new agreement.
These American actions in Nicaragua and Mexico showed that the United States still felt that it had special security interests south of its border. But its peaceful settlement of the Mexican crisis and support of elections in Nicaragua showed that it was willing to deal with disputes peacefully. America's policies in Latin America during the 1920s were in some ways similar to its policies elsewhere. It was a time of change, of movement, from one period to another. Many Americans were hoping to follow the traditional foreign policies of the past. They sought to remain separate from world conflict.
The United States, however, could no longer remain apart from world events. This would become clear in the coming years. Europe would face fascism and war. The Soviet Union would grow more powerful. And Latin America would become more independent. The United States was a world power, but it was still learning in the 1920s about the leadership and responsibility that is part of such power.
I'm Christopher Jones Cruz reporting from Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today.